Hello and welcome to the IC Companies and Markets Show. I'm Ian Smith, the Deputy Companies Editor of the IC. Joining me in the studio are Bradley Gerard, our news editor. How are you doing, Bradley?
Yeah, good, thank you. Apart from it's a bit chilly in the studio today, so.
And horrible weather outside. Yeah. Also in the studio we have Stephen Wilmot, our Companies Editor. How are you doing, Stephen?
Very well, Ian.
And over in the control room we have Daniel Liberto, our specialist writer. How are you doing, Daniel?
Fantastic, thanks.
Good. Just back from lunch. Was it good?
Excellent, yeah. Ate very well.
Ate very well. And we also have Dominic Toms on the controls. Hi, Dom. How are you doing?
Doing well.
If a reader was going to ask me how you used to sum up this podcast, what is this podcast going to be all about? I would use that classic political quote, "It's the economy, stupid." And I suppose that's where we'll start. Bradley, we've had some Q3 economic data concerning the UK. What are we seeing?
Yeah, it was a bit of a weaker quarter than expected. Services, production and agriculture were kind of areas that grew. But a big detractor was construction, where output fell 2.2%. Now, construction's only 6% of the economy, so well below the sort of 75% the services makes up. But I suppose the fact that construction was so weak is potentially an issue, especially maybe for our audience, given that actually the construction sector plays into things like house builders and that sort of thing, which have been very popular, have done very well. It maybe just points to maybe a little bit of softening in that sector, not sort of an outright sort of correction or anything. But it's probably worth investors sort of noting the trends in construction, given the sectors that are involved in it have been so popular for investors.
Yeah, and what it does do is perfectly set up our podcast, because we're going to be talking about the UK's unbalanced recovery. Stephen's written the cover feature this week, but we'll come on to that in a little bit. I suppose if we're going to talk about one sector that's stumbling, perhaps, Daniel, you've written about the home improvement sector. We've had trading statements from Travis Perkins and SIG. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, so there were two weak trading statements that came out from those two on the same day, actually, showing that basically in the third quarter over the summer, there was a lull in home improvement activity. And that kind of sparked a bit of a reaction. So some of the other DIY specialists, their shares also got hit. It's also kind of sparked wider fears about the housing market in general, really. People tend to do up their property before a sell and after a purchase. So there's that kind of, is activity here, does that kind of tell us something more about, where the housing market recovery is heading?
And also SIG has some kind of European operations, doesn't it, as well? What's the picture we're seeing outside of the UK?
I mean, they did complain that the UK operations were struggling, but it was most of the problems were coming from France. It seems that maybe the consumer confidence over there has dried up. And even though they've been kind of implementing a lot of self-help measures, profits have really taken kind of a bit of a pounding, really. And it's kind of quite worrying, because even though there was that lull, they didn't give any indication that things were improving. So shares have really been in free fall. They fell 21% when the trading statement came out, and they keep on falling. So yeah, some concerns out there.
And you also mentioned Elon Musk, just to round that off. Ian, tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, so that was a slightly different issue. There was an AGM statement basically saying that business was going well, but they mentioned some labour shortages in the UK roofing business. As a consequence, shares fell 14%. But I spoke with management there, and it seems that maybe markets have maybe overreacted a little. That issue appears to be a short-term one, and they're confident that they can kind of pick up, that business is picking up, and that roofing issue will go away. But yeah, again, that raises an issue about this kind of labour shortage concern, and that could maybe spread and impact other companies as well.
You've got to have someone to actually put the roof on, right? Okay, so let's talk about another kind of big news story this week, which was data breaches at major UK companies. Leading the news, obviously, TalkTalk. Bradley, take us through the basics there. What's going on?
As you say, TalkTalk, I think, was actually hit a little while ago as well, actually, at the time of the Dixon Carphone hack as well. So it's not great news. And shares have been on a bit of a roller coaster ride, to say the least. I mean, on Friday last week, they were at about 258p. They hit a low of 226 on Monday, reached a high of 262 on Tuesday, and now they're about 242. So it really has been up and down, up and down. The initial news of this sort of data breach obviously scared investors, and I think shares went down about 16%. And then somebody was arrested, a potential perpetrator, I think a 15-year-old in Northern Ireland or something. Shares bounced. But I think, I guess, what's important here is that investors kind of need to hear from TalkTalk, and I'm sure the company would be keen to do this quite soon. It would be to actually tell investors what they're going to do to stop this happening again in the future. Because it's all very well saying that the breach wasn't that material, and the data that was recovered by the hackers was not going to sort of lead to people's bank accounts being empty and that sort of thing.
But we are hearing more and more of these occurrences, right, to UK companies. And we've written in the past about cybersecurity and the companies that are involved in trying to defend businesses against these kind of attacks. But, yeah, I mean, there was another one that's come through as well, haven't we, the Optimal Payments?
Yeah, I mean, just today it's released a statement on the stock market saying that there have been breaches.
These go back a little bit of time.
Yeah, I mean, somebody's come forward and said basically that they've told the company they've got data which relates to 2011, 2012. I believe it's from sort of subsidiaries of Optimal Payments that it's bought through acquisition, I think. But yeah, it's again, even if you've bought a company and there's a data breach there, I mean, it just shows that even if you've got to have your own house in order, but you've got to make sure the house you're buying is in order as well, because you can buy companies and there can be issues there. And yeah, I guess the key thing is that companies are going to have to tell investors kind of what they're doing, how they're defending themselves. And I mean, like you say, maybe this is a chance to look at companies involved in data security. I mean, Theron, who wrote the piece in the magazine this week, notes that BAE Systems, I think, which has been hired by TalkTalk to investigate the hack, so maybe there's a play there. And Theron names a few others in the article as well, including Acumuli, as well as GB Group and a few others. So it could be a big opportunity for companies that specialise in sort of data security.
I suppose the bigger pitch for TalkTalk is the impact on the brand, right? If people see TalkTalk as a less reliable, less secure provider than others, over the longer term, which is harder to tell.
Yeah, and stories like this, obviously, with Twitter and things nowadays, they travel like wildfire. And in a way, it almost doesn't matter what the actual impact is. The fact that it's happened is enough, really, to potentially turn people off. I mean, I guess there's the safety net, I suppose. I mean, I don't know what your phone contract's like, but I think mine would be pretty difficult to get out of at a moment's notice. You're locked in for a year or 2 years sort of thing. So there's an element of the customer base has to be a bit sticky unless it probably wants to pay up the remainder of its contract. But it could arguably, I suppose, put new customers off going to the company. And there's a YouGov tool that has perhaps not surprisingly found a bit of negative sentiment towards the brand this week. So
okay, we'll see how that one plays out. What we've also had this week is Q3 earnings figures from some of the major listed companies. I've covered the banks. Lloyds and Barclays had less than spectacular figures, but Stephen, we've also looked at BP and Shell.
Yes.
What's going on there?
Well, the common theme that you see in these two Q3 results was that the executive teams are trying to convince investors that the companies can fund both their dividends and their investment programs with oil at $60 a barrel, which is not where it is now. Brent is at some 48, 49, something like that. But it, previously Ben van Beurden at Shell, for example, has repeatedly said, that the business will be fine at $70 a barrel, and in particular the BG takeover will be will make sense at $70 a barrel, which has been naturally kind of concerning investors, as it seemed increasingly backward looking as oil remains below $50 a barrel. So both of Ben van Beurden said today in the trading statement that that over the past year, what he said was actually quite specific. Let me get it right. So he said over the past year the company's dividends and its net investment were covered by the average oil price, which was over the past year $60 a barrel. Of course, that reflects the fact that it was falling from a much higher level, so that doesn't necessarily suggest that going forward. That suggests that if there is a long term average at $60 a barrel, they'll be fine. The dividend won't be cut. This has obviously been the chief worry of investors in Shell.
So they're trying to offer as much reassurance as they can while still being reasonably.
What that doesn't mean is that Shell can afford its dividends and net investment at the current current oil price.
So what we've seen is the oil majors scaling back on some of their spend, right?
Mark Robinson wrote the piece on BP in this week's issue, and he makes the point, which is that that actually BP, there was a silver lining in the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, and that it meant that BP was scaling back, or was selling off assets to try and fund these liabilities in the US at a time when the oil price was much higher. So actually it got some pretty good prices.
Right.
And so the other companies, you know, including Shell, which made the very unusual decision not just to kind of can some very speculative programs that hadn't yet started, but it actually halted production in the Canadian oil sands where it had started building kind of houses for staff and so forth. It had actually, you know, got there and got the pickaxes out and, you know, started work, and it sort of cooled that off. So that's really quite unusual, and it just shows how aggressive oil companies are getting and cutting back their development plans. But yeah, oil companies obviously need to balance these cutbacks against the need to sustain their production, so at the moment investors are very much focused on their dividends and whether they'll be covered by operating cash flow, but at another point in the cycle they might be much more interested in growth. And I suppose the difficulty is that they need to not cut back so much that they won't be able to actually sustain their production, you know, in a few years' time. So yeah, it's a tricky time for oil companies, but I suppose the takeaway of this week is that executives need to be getting more realistic about you know, oil being lower for longer.
Yeah, and you can read Mark's piece in the current this week's magazine, and you can read him on Shell online shortly. Mm. Okay, well, another kind of a big share price faller, even bigger this week, well, there's a couple, Meggitt and Chemring. Let's talk about UK defence sector, another kind of sector where some people were hoping for a recovery, but that's now proving to be restrained at best. Daniel, can I bring you back in there? You know, what's been going on this week?
That's right. There was a lot of noise that defence spending is picking up, both here and in the US, key markets. But two very kind of concerning trading updates came out. Firstly, from Chemring. Basically, they announced that a key contract to provide ammunition to the Middle East had been delayed. And that was particularly damaging because recently there was a big contract with the US Army which was cancelled. So they were kind of hoping for that contract to kind of fill in for that. And then it kind of was revealed that they were going to go to the market for a 90 million rights issue because basically the debt situation is becoming unmanageable. And the chief executive there has basically just said, you know, we're struggling to manage this debt. And that's restricting our ability to kind of focus on growth and operation improvement. And shares fell 23% on that. And to be honest, it's not looking good at the moment there.
And then, but you're more positive on Meggitt than you are on Chemring.
Yeah, well, Meggitt came out a day after with a profit warning as well. It's going to be interesting to see how things play out there. I'm still positive at the moment. But, you know, there was the kind of top line growth was weak across energy and military aviation markets, which wasn't necessarily surprising. But what is really concerning is just the kind of the lack of aftermarket work, which is, you know, the real lucrative area for Meggitt. And it seems that kind of they were making a lot of margin on kind of parts for older planes where there's kind of less of the kind of materials out there. So the companies kind of pay a premium for that. And as the kind of market's changing, there's less demand for that now. There's more of a focus on environmentally friendly planes and mm-hmm. technology is changing. And though I've got more confidence in Meggitt turn it around, it is something that we definitely need to keep tabs on here because that was one of the main reasons for tipping it was the kind of this aftermarket demand. And that's drying up at the moment and hopefully it will turn around.
And as in the home improvement sector, these two bad trading updates weighed more widely on the sector.
Yeah, that's right. There was a couple of other companies that got hit. Howden Joinery, Kingfisher, Grafton in particular. And in terms of defence sector, after those two trading statements came out, I also noticed that there was shares in a couple of the other companies were impacted, such as I think it was Senior, Ultra Electronics in Cobham. So yeah, definitely, I think, you know, these are very sensitive time for markets, and I think, you know, people are very kind of edgy, and you see these kind of updates coming out and you're thinking, you know, who else is going to be impacted by this? And, you know, it's natural to, you know, for there to be a reaction, especially after this kind of renewed optimism that defense spending was going up. And, you know, there is every sign that's going to happen, but clearly it hasn't filtered through to these companies yet, and there are some concerns.
Not good news for a very important sector for the UK economy, which brings us on to the wider feature this week. Obviously, we've talked about construction, we talked about defence there. Stephen, you start your feature talking about manufacturing and the relatively small size of the UK's manufacturing sector compared to its overseas economies. Take us through this. Why is this the case, and why should we be worried about it?
Yeah, well, this is obviously a topical subject because of the steel industry problems that we've had.
Tens of thousands of jobs being lost in that industry.
Yeah, well, actually not quite tens of thousands yet. There are only 30,000 jobs left in the industry, apparently. But we've had sort of 3,000 to 4,000 jobs being put at risk. And obviously that's galvanised the media attention. It's not particularly surprising. The steel sector in the UK has been in decline for decades. But it does show how bad we are at protecting our manufacturing sector, including compared to European peers and the US, which still has a decently sized manufacturing sector. And I guess that's the subject of this cover feature. I mean, why that's the case and whether it matters. We've been talking about a lot of bad news, haven't we? bad news from the oil majors, bad news from the aerospace or defence sector, also manufacturers who export. There have been a couple of good news snippets. For example, Next's results, and that's a good little microcosm of this feature. Actually, it's sort of, you know, the consumer economy has been doing well. But that's also storing up problems, notably a big current account deficit, and very low savings ratio, which we have in the UK. And I'm sort of looking at to what extent those are problems, and whether investors should be worried about them. To get back to your original question, you know, why has Britain got basically 10% of, well, estimates vary, but about 10% of the UK economy is manufacturing, compared to over 20% in Germany. I mean, Germany is always the obvious comparator because it's actually skewed in the opposite direction. They've got a very undeveloped consumer services sector, but a very overdeveloped manufacturing sector.
And George Osborne, as you've written about, has talked about previously about the march of the makers trying to transform the UK economy.
Exactly. And the interesting thing is that there has actually been some political momentum behind the idea that we should foster more of a manufacturing sector, which is in, you know, stark contrast to the last time the Conservatives were in government in the, you know, 80s and 90s. So that there has been something of a return to the idea that we should have an industrial strategy.
But you've talked about some of the hurdles that are in the way of that. We don't have enough infrastructure there to create that.
Yeah, there are lots of different problems, but yeah, people talk about lack of skills, lack of infrastructure. But a key one is access to finance. And I think this is quite an interesting one from a private investor's point of view, is that Britain has a very developed equity market. It's well over 100% of GDP is the value of the all share. Whereas in Germany, it's something like 40 or 50% of GDP. Basically, a lot of their economy is not equitized. That's not really a word, but you know what I mean. Whereas there, they've got very developed banking, and actually subsidized state banking sector, which hands out loans to sort of small and medium-sized businesses. And the thing about that debt finance is it does lend itself to long-term business creation, because owners can basically retain control, whereas if they have to sell out to another equity owner, they, you know, rapidly lose interest. And so this is, I mean, people often talk about this in the tech industry, right, that you know we don't have any tech giants in Britain because everyone always sells out after, you know, they're too focused on the exit, whereas you need a kind of messianic figure like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or Steve Jobs, who sort of pretends that their company isn't really a company at all and it's about, you know, taking over the world rather than making any money. And eventually then that, you know, so they seem less focused on that exit liquidity moment, as entrepreneurs talk about in some other countries. So that access to finance issue, I think, is perhaps the most crucial one, and that stops the development of smaller manufacturing businesses. But anyway, yeah, sorry, we digress slightly.
But I mean, the good news is, as you said, the consumer recovery. But this is patchy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the good news is that we have had an economic recovery, obviously, but like previous economic booms in the UK, it's been built on consumption and debt. And although debt hasn't picked up to a massive extent yet, basically savings jumped in the recession, and that savings ratio has been coming down, so that now households are neither saving nor borrowing. So we haven't got to the point where we're borrowing, but unless wage growth picks up quite strongly, we won't be able to sustain the kind of consumption growth we've been seeing without people getting into debt. Mm-hmm. So that's the point at which we're at the moment. Luckily, wage growth has picked up. That's largely a result of very low inflation, but also wage settlements have been better over the past year or so.
I mean, we have seen an uptick in certain areas of lending around, borrowing around, buying cars and point of sale,
absolutely.
Retail finance.
Actually, you've written very eloquently about this, and yeah, no, actually that's a very good point.
But is that not across the board? Is that just certain?
Yeah, I mean, in aggregate, the households are neither borrowing nor saving. One of the most interesting ways of playing this theme on the stock market, as we've talked about a lot, is through lenders, because this kind of increasing consumer confidence is feeding into strong mortgage approval figures and as you say, unsecured lending, mm-hmm. You know, motor finance and so forth, and you know, a number of your tips, Close Brothers and so forth, have fed into that.
I suppose we've seen small businesses borrowing as well. That's been stronger. But what do you think about the potential impact of rising rates on this kind of consumer recovery?
Well,
is that a worry?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a worry. I mean, it's obviously been a worry for ages, and it hasn't affected the sector in any meaningful way yet. So one doesn't want to kind of kill the party too early, I suppose. But I think that's what investors in the sector need to be aware of. You know, by all means, continue to celebrate your stock picking success in house builders and the alternative lenders, if you've been in that space, or you know, some of the consumer discretionary names, Whitbread, for example. I mean, it had some very good results last week. Those companies have been doing extremely well, and it looks like they will continue to do well. You know, again, Next had a very strong third quarter set of figures. It's hard to get very excited about companies like, well, about the oil majors or the, you know, defence names when you've got much, much stronger figures coming out of these consumer stocks.
Many of which you've picked in your feature, but you've talked about some.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, the party won't last forever, and we've got to be, you know, so you know, investors should keep a close eye on things like wage growth, the savings ratio, things which suggest that, you know, which indicate whether the boom is sustainable or not, basically. And interest rates are another one, because one of the things that, I mean, I think I've got the graph in this feature, but the household debt to income ratio in the UK is much higher than in other countries, and that's because of high house prices. So there are assets which are backing those liabilities, but it does mean that, and we have quite short term mortgages in this country. So the longest you can fix a mortgage for is about 5 years. unlike in the US where you can fix it for the lifetime of the mortgage. So that does mean that we're much more exposed to rising interest rates than other countries.
But in conclusion, you see reasons to be cheerful.
But yeah, but I mean, so there are these things to focus on, to worry about. But on balance, it certainly seems like a better idea to stick with the consumer stocks than to get involved in some of the other sectors which are exposed to all of these global headwinds that we've been talking about earlier in the show. But people need to. I would say there are two takeaways. One is you need to watch out for these things like debt levels picking up and the savings ratio and so forth and wage growth that might indicate the cycle is turning. And second, it's probably a good idea to have some high quality exporters in your portfolio as a hedge against a sudden collapse in the sterling and it all going horribly wrong, because obviously it's just very hard to see what might change when you haven't got to that point, that inflection point yet. And a hedge is never a bad thing.
And definitely not. And I suppose just turning to the results section, there's not been very much this week. It's been a quieter week for results, but we have had the bigger news. I suppose Debenhams chief executive's going to leave. Talking about consumer stocks, it's going to be leaving the business next year. And that seemed to be a reasonably decent set of numbers that met analysts' expectations there. You think that's kind of playing on some of the things you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not a standout. I mean, the retail, as I've also talked about in the feature, the retailers, ironically, aren't the best way to play this consumer recovery. They're the most obvious way in a way, but
because of the changes to the sector and the move to online, the
e-commerce and stuff, it's kept a lot of the old guard have been caught really off guard by the changes. And so, retail is a bit of a mixed bag. However, we did actually upgrade Debenhams to a speculative buy because they've got good yield, 4% yield, and the stock's cheap on 11 times forward earnings. And obviously it is exposed to this theme. It hasn't been one of the obvious beneficiaries of the shift to e-commerce, shall we say. they've got very inefficient store estate, but it looks like they are sort of in the early stages of a turnaround.
Fascinating. Elsewhere in the issue this week, we've got Chris Dillow talking about the disease of rising house prices and how unproductive it is for the nation to be pouring its money into housing. Bearball column this week looks at Brexit and why it would be bad for IC readers as it would hit house prices in London and the South East. Mark Robinson's looked at commodities, especially how falling Chinese demand is hitting Dr. Copper. All that and more, £4.50 in all good news agents. Thank you very much.